A podcast of the cinema.
What was that?
I don't know. I'm trying to wake myself up. I just had a nap and I want to be enthusiastic. Peppy, pep, pep, pep.
How about you decrease your excitement for just a moment? For maybe not just a moment. For perhaps the rest of the podcast.
How about you don't tell me what to do ever?
It's important that I maintain your tone and
I'll give you tone.
Moderate it and police it.
You're gonna get tone from me.
I have to make sure that you're not too exciting on the microphone.
I'm younger than springtime
because
and twice
I
as
don't
exciting.
Have it in me to be peppy, such as the way you have just been.
Okay, fine.
You know what I mean.
I will just slow it down.
I didn't say impersonate me. Me, my name is Dave White.
Yes, and I'm Alonzo Durrell.
Hang on now.
What?
I'm a very important film critic for The Wrap.
So important.
.com.
So thoroughly.
You are as well.
I guess.
You're sort of maybe more important than me because you're the main film critic for The Wrap, and you're the editor for the reviews, which means you're my editor, which kind of means you're my boss, but God help you.
Oh, I'm the boss of you.
If you ever try to...
I'm the boss of you 24/7.
Fix my beautiful prose. Oh,
let me get my buzzsaw out. Yes, we are film critics for The Wrap.
I have
and,
to tell you a thing.
Yes, what?
In 30 minutes,
uh-huh.
We have to stop the recording so that I can fix up the dinner.
Okay.
The last 30 minutes are the orso pasta goes in.
Gotcha.
And then it gets to cook in the oven more.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is why people demanded that we started a food podcast.
Well, not, but the people who already listen to the food podcast already know.
Yes.
What it is I'm making.
Yes.
It's my second go-round.
Yes.
With Nigella Lawson's chicken in a pot with lemon and orso.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of pasta. Like big, fat, thick rice.
That I saw the chicken in the refrigerator getting all, you know, skin dry.
Yes.
Did you spatchcock it?
No, it just flattened itself out that way.
Oh, okay.
It was lazy or tired or both.
Gotcha. It's having a rest.
And yeah. So, but now in the pot, it's all, you know, snugly contained in all the leeks and carrots and whatnot.
Yes.
And it's perked itself right back up, you see.
Linoleum Knife and Fork, available to our Patreon subscribers
Hang
at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
We'll do a little ad spot at the end
just a little,
for ourselves.
Just throwing it out there. That's not a spot.
But we have five films to talk about.
Yes.
This week. And that's ostensibly the most important thing about this show.
Sure.
I am finally giving up on getting myself a chance to see Ordinary Love
okay.
in a movie theater because it's down to one screen somewhere and it's out in the middle of I don't even know where. And I missed the boat on it. It was such a tiny release. I mean, you would think it would have been a bigger movie.
No.
No?
It's
But it has a big movie star in it.
It has
the Liam Neeson.
It has the Liam Neeson, but he is not like Tuchin.
Liam Neeson, though.
What Come about on. Liam Neeson? He is not taking anybody. It is a somber film.
I want to see it because it's about old people who are married who are dying, and that's a theme that I you know.
Mm. It is.
I need to be able to make plans when it's your turn and my turn to become the aggrieved widower.
Oh, I see.
Aggrieved or grieving? Grieving.
Grieving. No, you're aggrieved already. That's a whole other thing.
Grieving. The grieving widower. And we already saw Away From Her.
Oh, this isn't that sad.
Oh, it's not?
Well.
Oh, okay.
I mean, come, you saw me.
I'm going to walk right out all peppy and singing a song.
No, but you saw me at the end of Away From Her. That was devastating.
I had to reassemble you and...
Yeah.
And carry you piggyback to the car.
In a bucket. No, this is sad, though. It's Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville, and they play a married couple who've been together for a long time. They have a charmingly barbed kind of patter between them.
What do you mean?
Like, you know, like they're a long-time couple with a sense of humor.
The On Golden Pond kind of thing, where they're always insulting each other?
Not quite to that level, but it is, it's a little spiky, you know.
All right.
But all with an undercurrent of genuine affection.
Okay.
And, you know, they've had tragedy in their past. They had a child who died.
Okay.
And then Leslie Manville's character is diagnosed with cancer.
Okay.
And so, you know, they have to sort of navigate all of this stuff. And, you know, it gets very much into the kind of day-to-day issues of just like, you're on chemo and, you know, you feel like crap and this person is trying to take care of you and you don't want anybody to take care of you. You just want to like... keep vomiting and just like be angry at everybody.
Right.
She winds up becoming friends with this guy who had been their daughter's school teacher years earlier, who's also going through treatment, who's gay. And the two of them become really close because, you know, she's sort of able to talk to him about stuff in a way that she isn't able to talk about Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson actually winds up sort of befriending the partner of this teacher because, like, he'll come to the hospital with him, but he'll just sit in the cafeteria because he can't deal with, you know, going with him for the, you know, sitting there while the chemo is happening or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it is, I'm not surprised this isn't a giant release because it's not a movie where, like, a lot of things happen.
Oh, I see.
But it is very much about just these two people and their relationship and how this sort of haymaker, you know, like affects their lives. And yeah, it's moving and it's beautiful. And I did get choked up some, but it's not an Away From Her situation.
Who's the filmmaker?
I don't remember.
Why don't you pause the...
I saw this movie like a month ago now because I kept waiting for you to talk about it.
How do you walk into this podcast?
Well, because seconds before we started, you were like, oh, and you can talk about Ordinary Love now because I'm just never going to get to see it. I did not get any kind of warning. It is directed by two people, Lisa Barros Dessa and Glenn Layburn.
All right.
Written by Owen McCafferty. I'm not super familiar with any of these people's previous films.
Okay.
But this one's quite good. And the two lead performances are what you want them to be. Leslie Manville is, you know, a goat. And I mean, greatest of all time, older listeners.
Thank you. I'm glad you clarified.
Yes.
This is the third feature from... Lisa Barros Dessa.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen any of the others.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, eventually the DVD will show up on our door.
I would think so.
Step.
Yes.
And I'll watch it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I like a good cryy movie.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that.
That's the thing about it, though, I think, is that it doesn't hammer the notes the way an American movie would.
I think
you go in knowing what this movie's about and you are expecting it to hit certain plot beats. And it's just not doing that. And it doesn't want to do that. And so it's more restrained, you know. I mean, it is still moving and it's still emotional. And you know, she gets to act the crap out of, you know, like the shaving her head and all that stuff, you know,
right,
those moments, but it doesn't like, it never tugs at your heartstrings in a way that, like, a lot of, you know, like something like The Family Stone does, you know, or tries to do. This is a much subtler film, and I think that's why it might have put off American audiences, because it doesn't hit the beats you're expecting in a cancer movie. You know, it's no less heartfelt because of it. If anything, I think more so, because you really are taking these people on as people and not just like tragic figures in a tragic story.
Will it help me figure out a plan for when you die first?
What if I'm the Liam Neeson?
That cannot happen.
I know it would be monstrously inconvenient.
It would be.
But you never know.
I have to be in control of all this stuff. Oh, I know. See. And I, so yes. it's very important to me that I make sure that everything's taken care of.
Okay, well, you should start leaving me like lists just in case.
It's not a bad idea. Yes. I do like things to be taken care of. And if you have to be the one, I don't want you to muddle and fuddle your way through it.
Because if you're the Leslie Manville, you're not even going to be able to focus on your own recovery. You're just going to be bossing me around all the time. So maybe do that now while neither of us is the Leslie Manville.
I promise to boss you around until I'm dead.
Oh, that was, I think, if that wasn't in our wedding vows, it was at least implicit. I will watch this again.
Give me a scale so I can finally decide if I'm going to watch it.
Okay.
Interesting filmmaking.
Yes.
Kind of run-of-the-mill filmmaking.
No.
You know, are we talking like middlebrow-y kind of stuff, like the King's Speech kind of film?
No. This is a movie that
closer to like 45 years, maybe?
Closer to 45 years. All right. I would say like it's in the 45 years, maybe all, at times even the amour section.
Really?
Yeah. I love the design of their house and the way that it's shot.
Yeah.
And I love how much this, I love a movie that trusts you to pick up on things and doesn't tell you all the stuff you have to know all the time with a big bicycle horn. And this is that kind of movie.
Well, what a good segue into a film that you didn't see, but I did.
Oh, there we go.
Speaking of
movies that don't tell you anything.
So there is a German filmmaker, Angela Schanelek. I may be killing her name. I hope I'm not. She has a new film, making a very limited rollout to about a dozen cities. If you want to know which cities, if you're close to one of them, go to cinemaguild.com, and that will, the list of play dates and even where it's playing in that city is there on the site. I know because I checked it earlier today. So the name of this film is I Was at Home, comma, but ellipsis. And if you are...
Is it about how the FedEx guy doesn't leave the package, even though we were here?
No, but the title does reference a movie from the 1930s, an Ozu film, called I Was Born, But...
Oh, okay. I thought that sounded familiar.
Although, you know, what this film has in common with Ozu is a decided... stillness.
Right.
And, you know, a focus on domestic upheavals that are incredibly quiet. They're not big, loud cataclysms. They are, though the cataclysms already either happened or they are few and far between. In fact, there are only two loud moments in this whole movie. Both of them committed by the same character. I will give you a very simple plot outline. There is a woman in her late 30s, early 40s. She is a widow. Her husband has been dead 2 years. She has two children. One of them is about 12 or 13, a boy. The other is 7, 8, a girl. And when the film begins, at least when the human beings arrive in the film, I'll get to that in a moment. There is a problem with the son. He made himself a bit of a disciplinary problem in school by vanishing. He just sort of left. And he comes home. And this has upset the mother in a way that is simmering under the surface. She is already a person experiencing grief and has been now for a couple of years. But now her children are sort of pushing her to a bit of a meltdown. Mm. Complicating matters is the kid has injured his foot. It's infected. He has to have a toe amputated. Yeah. So that adds to her, like, disarray, the mom. And because of this, and this is how I'm piecing it together, and I'll explain why I'm having to piece it together in a bit. Because of this, other normal sort of interactions with human beings, like the mom is trying to buy a bike from a guy that she doesn't know, and the bike is sort of not functioning. And instead of being reasonable about it, she kind of
flips out.
A little bit. She runs into a filmmaker professor friend that she knows. And she accosts him on the sidewalk and tells him that she hasn't seen all of his film, but she hates it. And here's why. And it's the longest monologue in the film. In a film that there isn't a lot of dialogue in. She has a bit of a confrontation with the teachers at the kid's school who are all trying to decide what to do with this, with the son. And it goes like that, where everyday occurrences take on greater emotional tension than they might otherwise. And in the middle of all this, there are two other narratives taking place. Two of the teachers at the school are trying to figure out if they're going to have a baby or even how deeply their relationship goes. And then there is this very odd return back and again many times to a middle school classroom reading / production of Hamlet. And as the kids, each scene where the kids are performing Hamlet, they are given the single most Bressonian line readings that I have seen in a film in years. They are deadpan. They are robotic. There is even a sort of, are you catching this sort of filmmaking nod to Lancelot du Lac, which is a Bresson film, where the kids are staging...
His very dour King Arthur movie.
Yes, where the kids are staging a sword fight, but all you see are their hands and feet, which is an incredibly Bressonian move. So you have three things happening. The main story, a little sub-story about the teachers and what they want to do with their lives. And do they want to have any kids that are going to cause this much trouble, And then the kids themselves who are enacting a grand tragedy in an incredibly distant way. Bracketing all of this is an opening and closing shot of a dog chasing a rabbit, a dog catching the rabbit, a dog eating the rabbit, and then a donkey walking in. Standing next to the dog lies down to take a nap. That's the first scene in the film. The last scene in the film is the donkey and the dog, and the dog is still taking a nap. The end. To call this film minimalist is, one, appropriate, and two, almost maybe an understatement, because
it barely scratches the surface.
The signposts that you were talking about earlier that often guide traditional narratives, mm-hmm, do not exist here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you are tasked with sorting out how these three stories connect, or if they do at all, and what those animal, you know, observational scenes mean.
This movie was at what festival? Where did you...
I don't know.
Oh, I thought you would... I thought you'd been reading about it because it had like a big...
Oh, I guess it was at Berlin like last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I've been reading about it throughout the year. I think it was in Film Comment up to the end of the year, like unreleased in the United States yet, but watch for it when it comes, that
gotcha,
kind of thing.
Gotcha.
And so I've had 24 hours since watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me in 24 days and I might have an entirely different understanding of it. I haven't read any other reviews, although I tried this morning.
Uh-huh.
The reason I tried, I'll explain in a moment. But here's what I think so far. This is a relentlessly observational film. And not much happens that is out of the ordinary. Other than, you know, people suddenly deciding they want to lie down on the ground for stretches of time. So you have sort of inscrutable animal behavior at the beginning of the film. And then you have equally inscrutable human behavior throughout the film. And part of me thinks that is that connection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also thinking in terms of the kids in the classroom doing Hamlet and their performance directly relating to the mother's, you know, rant in the middle of the film to the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. The filmmaker, who, by the way, is very calm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's played by an actual filmmaker who made a film called All the Cities of the North a few years ago, which I have not seen. But in her sort of complaint to him, as he stands there passively listening to her, she says, any time an actor is in a film, it's a lie. Any time actors are emoting, it's a lie. And she's specifically complaining to him about his use of actors encountering a real person facing death in his film. And she said, you shouldn't have done that, because real death can only make people acting about death into an insult, into a lie. Which, if you extend it to the way that the kids in the Hamlet scenes are behaving, that's kind of what Bresson was doing with his actors often. He was forcing them to take out all of their actorly manners and just read lines so as to distill cinema down to a more pure form. I'm guessing right now. All I know is that the melancholy atmosphere of this film and the beauty of the filmmaking refusal to tell you what to think at all puts it squarely into my jam kind of filmmaking.
As somebody who hasn't seen it, it seems like there's something sort of self-consciously, not cinematic per se, but cinema referential. If you've got
a little bit of that. I mean, I don't want to oversell the references to Ozu and Bresson,
but that's not
where she's really going here.
But she does it. She names her film similarly to an Ozu film.
I know she does.
She trots out.
But
a
you
donkey.
Haven't seen it.
I understand.
And so
I'm just saying, what I'm
anytime you make a movie like this and you bring a donkey into the frame, you're like, okay, what are you doing?
I see you.
I see your donkey.
But like, but also the fact that the longest monologue of the film is about filmmaking.
Yes. There is that, but that's not the only thing to it.
Okay.
This is a film about people asking existential questions mm-hmm. and not knowing the answers and not knowing how to be and sort of unraveling in really, really quiet ways.
Is the to be or not to be speech part of the Hamlet sequence, or is it just the climactic sword fight?
Bits and pieces. The death of Ophelia, the sword fight, you know, the last scene.
Gotcha.
And so I might love this film. I definitely want to watch it again later in the year when there's a DVD release or that we get a streaming link. I would love to show it to you because I really want your input on stuff that I'm excited about that you might not be the perfect target audience for. Not because I'm trying to torture you, but because...
That's just a plus.
It is an added bonus. But I get so, you know, wrapped up in films like this and I want to think about them more, and I want to talk about them more, and I want to read about them more. I want to see them again so that I can see if I have changed my mind or not. But filmmakers who do this sort of thing, y'all automatically have my attention because they are moving outside of
narrative constraints,
typical avenues of expression. So the reason I tried to look up a review today and couldn't was because my monthly free allotment of Los Angeles Times on the internet articles ran out.
Mine too, and it's March 1st. We should have a whole new fresh batch of them.
And I have not subscribed online to LA Times. I know I should.
You did hear old people talking about...
Well, that's why I went to look for it. Because, I get there. I'm one of 8 people in the audience. I'm the youngest person by 20 years. I'm 55.
Yeah.
Which is the experience of going to the Lemley Royal.
Sure.
It's one of the oldest old person film movie theaters in the city. And I know that going in, I'm content with that. I ain't got nothing against old people. I hope to be one someday.
Indeed.
Or rather, even older than I am. Oh, they did card me, in a manner of speaking. They did ask me when I asked for one ticket, they said one adult. Meaning?
Senior?
Maybe a senior.
Student?
And if they had automatically given me the senior discount, like they did when I saw Olivia last summer with Robbie, because they thought I was his father. Then I would have just allowed it to happen.
Of course.
But when they ask, I don't want to say, yes, I'm a senior, and then have them say, may I see your ID? Like, I don't want that, because I don't want to be caught in that lie.
I'm actually 3 40-year-olds in a trench coat.
Also, I do want to give the Lemleys that extra dollar.
Sure, why not?
Because I want them to stick around. Anyway, I go see it. The movie's over. I turn around. 3 people have walked out during the course of the film.
Yeah.
There are only 5 of us left. And as I'm walking out, 2 of them, one of the older women, says to her older male viewing companion, well, Justin Chang said it was great, so I don't know.
So have you told him
this afternoon? I texted Justin and I said, let me tell you about yesterday. And he texted me back and he said, this is not the first time people have texted me and told me stories like this. He goes, it happened last year when I talked about, or the year before when I talked about Zama, and also Claire Denis' Let the Sunshine In. People were upset with me for recommending them.
Ah.
So here I am recommending.
Yes.
I was at home, comma, but ellipsis, because here's the thing. The title itself is, but what? Really? And if you were at home, shouldn't everything be okay? So everything isn't okay at home. And the question is, but what? And so that's kind of something what you might be asking yourself when the movie's over, like, but what? I am going to enthusiastically recommend this to people who know that they want to see this kind of film.
Fair enough.
Maybe if you're even on the fence, and sometimes you trust me and sometimes you don't, because, you know, if you listen to this show long enough, you know that I'm always out here pushing the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Look for it. CinemaGuild.com.
Mr. Difficult Listening Hour.
Right? I'm leaning toward this being great.
Okay.
Talk to me later about it, and I'll tell you more about why. Or maybe I will have changed my mind. But right now, into it fully.
All right. Shall I talk about Scream Queen?
Let's talk about that Invisible Man.
Oh, sure.
In about 2 minutes, I'm going to need to stop the recording, but start in.
Okay, so Invisible Man is Lee Whannell, the guy who behind Insidious, and
that
Saw,
guy.
And him, taking on the Invisible Man story, as Bibbs pointed out in his review for the Wrap.
William Bibbiani.
The name H.G. Wells is nowhere to be found in these credits,
right?
Which is fine. It's a the concept of an Invisible Man, but it's taken.
It has nothing to do with the original story.
It has nothing to do with the original story. Yeah. And the focus here isn't the Invisible Man. It's about the Invisible Man's ex, played by Elizabeth Moss. She is involved with this wealthy genius and who's a master of optics and also like a horrible, horrible abusive monster.
Uh-huh.
She manages to sneak away from him in the middle of the night and like get away from him. And, you know, is traumatized by it, like is constantly afraid he's going to come after her, like can barely leave the house where she's hiding out. And about a couple of months after this goes down, she finds out that he is dead and he has left her $5 million.
Yeah.
But then things start going strange. She starts sensing a presence in the room, even when she can't see anybody. Emails are sent to people out of her account that she did not write. Terrible things happen to people in her presence that she insists she did not do, but no one believes her.
Right.
And so this is a brilliant metaphor about gaslighting and spousal abuse.
Yeah.
Disguised as a horror thriller.
I wouldn't say it's disguised. I'm just saying that this is a horror thriller.
Baked into a horror thriller.
About those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I find it super effective on all fronts. I was scared by it.
Oh, sure. You sure were. I was right next to you.
Yeah. I found it very scary. And I think, and you know, the whole, it taps into that whole thing of like, this terrible thing is happening. And it sounds ridiculous and no one believes me. And I sound crazy when I tell people about it. So how can I convince anyone that this terrible thing is happening to me? Why don't you go check the oven? We'll be right back. Oh, my. So much has happened since last we spoke.
We took a little break so that I could fill the chicken pot with orso and...
I went to the grocery store. It's been a whole adventure.
I feel like we're working on a second podcast now.
Practically, I know. Anyway, so yeah, I think Invisible Man, I found it super effective just on a sheer genre level, but also as, you know... I mean, and this is generally the case. I'm not trying to say like, oh, wow, it's a horror movie. It's about something. Like most horror movies are about something.
If they aren't, then what that means is that they are generally lazy and bad.
Yes.
So, yeah.
But so this one, I think, succeeds in its metaphorical efforts while not skimping on the sensations.
And when I say that, when I say what I just said, what I mean is, every film is about something.
Exactly.
And they might just even be a reaction to something that's going on in the world without explicitly being about that thing.
Yes.
Lazy and bad for me means just kills,
mm-hmm.
nothing interesting, the kills aren't exciting, because I love a slasher movie of the 1980s, as you know, or any era, really. But I want there to at least be some atmospherics happening in my slasher movie. So that's what I meant by that. I want people coming in at me going, what about me? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This movie builds to a climax that is chef's kiss.
I hesitate to speak of too much here because I want y'all, A, to see this, and B, to be as jaw-droppingly surprised as I was, because there's a moment in this film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a moment that is built on top of other moments that are increasingly surprising and shocking. But there is a shock moment. It's not a jump scare, but there's a shock moment in this movie that the press screening audience gasped at. Mm-hmm. And my mouth went agape. I was like, oh no. And the other thing I loved was how at one point I thought it was over. And then it wasn't over. And there was more to come. So I found myself surprised, which is, that's A+ in a thriller. If you've surprised me, because I'm really terribly jaded when it comes to this sort of thing.
Sure.
We've discussed that before many times. Jump scares don't mean anything to me. I live for, you know, being surprised by stuff, by films that are, horror films, thrillers.
We've all been Shyamalan, you know.
Like, yeah.
We're conditioned to look for, you know.
And this really took me to a place. Mm-hmm. So I don't, like I said, I don't want to give away too much. It is, there's a level of cruelty in this film that I haven't seen in a long time. There are some just very elegantly awful things that take place. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, y'all, come on in. We're still recording a podcast.
But do come in.
Yeah. Family just came over for dinner. Mm-hmm. So I am, like I say, don't want to say too much. This is cool filmmaking.
Yes.
I would like to talk about Elizabeth Moss for a moment.
Yes.
And how perfect she is at being punished and terrorized.
There was an article this week. It
was was there?
Yeah, like the terrorization of Elizabeth Moss. I forgot why. Well, which is why I'm all for her getting that Hallmark Christmas movie. She says she wants to be in.
She needs a treat.
Yes.
Yeah. So
let her decorate those cookies.
She can have a Hallmark movie as a treat.
Exactly.
So the but more than just her, like carrying every moment on her shoulders. Mm-hmm. The supporting cast is cool.
Yes.
As well.
Aldous Hodge, Storm Reid.
MC Ren in Straight Outta Compton.
He's in, I think, just Mercy.
Which I have not seen yet.
Yeah.
And he, and Storm Reid in a role that could have just been not much.
Yeah.
Is giving you stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The woman who plays her sister, whose name I don't know. I had difficulty with her character throughout until I realized why I was having difficulty with her character, and then I wasn't anymore.
Harriet Dyer.
Okay. So anyway, everything about this is cool.
Yeah.
And you should see it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Unless the subject matter is super unpleasant for you,
sure.
And then don't.
No. Yeah, if this in any way sounds, you know, like it's, yeah, then don't, because it is about that thing. You know?
Right. Speaking of horror movies.
Yes.
There is a new documentary out.
Yes, Scream Queen.
Scream, comma, Queen.
My Nightmare on Elm Street.
It's the second comma movie of the week.
Yes. This has a colon and an exclamation point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's about Mark Patton. And if you don't, if that name doesn't immediately ring a bell.
It did not ring a bell for me either, so.
He was a very hot up-and-coming actor in the early 1980s. He appeared in the Broadway stage version of Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, in the cast that included Cher and Sandy Dennis and Karen Black, and then was cast by Robert Altman along with the rest of the cast of the play to be in the film version.
Yeah.
He followed that up with a starring role in what was, you know, designed to be a very big deal.
Yeah.
A sequel to a very popular horror film, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge.
Yes.
And what was unusual about that film, in just in its basic structure, is that it has a male lead and a male sort of lead victim.
Yes.
Who is fighting off Freddy Krueger, who is trying to come back to life in this guy's body.
Yes.
As such, there is an automatic kind of homoerotic undercurrent to this notion of like one man trying to possess another one, trying to get inside another man.
Yes.
And then the movie kind of doubles down on that with this, like, sadistic coach character who hangs out at a leather bar and,
right.
like, winds up getting lashed to a shower naked and
yeah.
beaten with towels by Freddy Krueger. And, you know, like, all these other things where...
There isn't just queer subtext in this movie. It's text.
It's text.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And they say that in the movie, in fact.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and Patton himself, being a gay actor, found that he had a hard time getting hired after that. His agents told him flat out, well, obviously you can carry a movie, but we have to put you up as a character actor now because you can't play straight.
Right. And, I mean, cinema history is full of gay male actors who successfully, stayed in the closet
mm-hmm.
and had everybody believing that they were heterosexual.
Yes.
Both on screen and off.
They had a performative butchness.
Rock Hudson.
Cary Grant.
Cary Grant, who was bisexual. That is, you know, that's the history of Hollywood.
Yeah.
In the world of actors who do not, you know, read as heterosexual, options have always been limited. In the early years, there was often...
You could be Edward Everett Horton.
You could be the character that was sort of typed as the sissy.
Yes.
You know.
You could be the butler in a Fred Astaire movie going, ooh, sir.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But there was no room for that guy in films as anything except a punchline
mm-hmm.
or a diabolical villain.
Right.
You know, that the Rock Hudson Doris Day movie where she's talking to the other decorator man about the color of the floor. The color of the floor is lilac.
Yes.
And she says, we have to change this. Who has a lilac floor? And he says, I have. And she says, well, you're not like other people. And
we're trying to sell this product to regular, ordinary people. To which he responds, oh, them. This is in Lover Come Back, by the way.
Yeah, so anyway, up until the new queer cinema, we didn't get a lot thrown at us unless we, as, you know, queer people who were also actors,
staked it out ourselves.
And I don't mean we as in me, because I've never been an actor, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Like, you weren't, if you couldn't pass, you couldn't advance.
Yeah.
And as this film progresses, as Nightmare 2 progresses, this guy reads as gay.
Yeah.
Increasingly, as the film moves forward.
They give him this dance number that was designed to be like Tom Cruise in Risky Business, but it just kind of comes out super gay.
Something else. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, of course, AIDS is exploding in Hollywood and people are freaking out about that stuff. And
there is absolutely an AIDS
panic
happening in this film as well.
Oh, that's true.
What I think is most interesting about this documentary is this guy's life.
Yes.
Outside, because by the end of the 80s, he had given up. He'd quit.
Yeah, he literally flees to Mexico.
His boyfriend had died, and he left the country to go to Mexico and just open a store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it sort of was so off the grid that when the documentary Never Sleep Again, which was about sort of the history of the entire Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, tried to find him, they had to hire a private detective.
Yeah.
And so after he did that documentary and sort of realized that, that Nightmare 2 sort of has this interesting place in the culture where queer academics and queer horror fans have sort of embraced it, while at the same time, of course, the internet being the internet, there's all these people talking about what a fag this guy is,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
You know, he kind of comes wading back into the public eye. And it, over the course of this film, you follow him to like going to horror cons and all this stuff. And ultimately, you know, coming to terms with his, you know, sort of individual place as what they refer to him as, the as horror cinema's first male scream queen. So yeah, it is, you know, you're right. He's I think one of the more interesting aspects of the film, but it's also, I think, the discussion.
Well, he's kind of all I cared about, because the film itself, Nightmare 2 itself, is easy enough to read.
Sure.
If you are queer. If True. You are not, it wasn't made for you. and if you didn't get that as you watched it, and you just thought it was like a schlocky teenage horror movie,
right,
it's because the world, you exist in a world that we don't exist in.
Right. Yeah. It was cool seeing some friends that we know in the movie.
Yeah.
Fozzie was in it doing an interview. Andy Scahill's an academic I've known for a long time, is interviewed in the film. I'm surprised, like, there are some other, like, major kind of queer horror people I'm surprised they didn't talk to, like Michael Verratti, for one.
Right.
But, like, really, but, you know, Peaches.
Who knows?
But Peaches Christ is in there. And,
yeah.
I think the narration.
It's a little cheaply, roughly made.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a polished film.
Yeah.
In documentary, you know, terms.
Yeah. I think it is the kind of doc that is mostly successful for its subject matter than for its filmmaking.
Yes.
But I'm glad it exists. And
no, me too. I'm happy it's out there. It's definitely informative.
Yeah.
And it really digs into the thing I always feel like when an actor or actress just stops.
Mm-hmm. Where do they go?
Where do they go? Like, I want to know,
sure,
that they're okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think, all right, what happened to you? Did you have a nice life after you stopped doing this?
Yeah.
Particularly if you had achieved any sort of fame or notoriety, how do you navigate the descent from,
right,
being well-known to being, you know, regular old citizen again.
Exactly.
Because we do certainly elevate people,
yeah,
in that way, and we feel bad for them if they aren't getting to do the thing they do and be recognized for it.
Right.
I don't know why we do that, but I'm, you know.
You know, he also, I think, makes a, and we've talked before about how, like, there is this sort of missing generation of gay men, you know, who, like.
Oh, absolutely there is.
And he kind of talks about being a survivor of that and sort of wanting younger people to understand that everything that queer people have now as a foothold in society was hard won for them by people who aren't around anymore.
When I came out in 1989, I knew exactly one older gay man.
Yeah.
That's it. They were all dead.
Yeah. We had
I didn't know anybody. I knew people my own age and younger.
We had a generation that really had to scramble to find mentorship.
Yes.
Because
for sure.
So many people were gone. I mean, obviously not all of them. And I have, especially here, I have a lot of friends who are of that generation, and they have meant the world to me and really, you know, helped me out, yeah, a lot over the years. But, you know, speaking in the broader terms, yeah, a lot of those folks not around. And so it's cool to have him kind of being in this way where he's meeting young fans and he's talking to people and sort of being able to kind of say, hey, look, you know, we're all standing on the shoulders of somebody else.
Right.
And you know, because the young gays, they got to learn, you know. Teach the children.
That's your new favorite thing to say. I'm going to teach the children.
That's right.
Hey, guys. The Romanian New Wave is back.
Woo! Not that it really left.
You've been waiting for the next installment of the Romanian New Wave. It's been going on for so long now. Do we still call it the Romanian New Wave?
They,
or do we just call it the recent Romanian cinema? I think that's what we do.
There's they keep updating the Romanian New Wave page on Wikipedia with new films, including The Whistlers.
Yes, which opens this weekend.
Yes. This is a film that premiered last year at Cannes. It is the latest from Corneliu Porumboiu.
Yes.
Sorry if I'm butchering that name.
I'm sure we are.
Yeah, he's he directed Police Adjective and
Infinite Football,
which I haven't seen.
Man, do I love Infinite Football. It's not even a narrative. It's a documentary about a guy who wants to rewrite all the rules of football, and he's obsessed with it. This is kind of a sequel to Police Adjective.
It picks up on themes, and it shares some cast members, although they're not playing the same roles.
Right. Right. Vlad Ivanov, who was the abortion doctor in 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Yes. Winner of the LA Film Critics Best Supporting Actor.
Yes. Who was also a character in Police Adjective, is now playing what might be the older version of the main character from Police Adjective, although they never tell you.
Yeah, but he's got the same.
If he is or if he isn't,
he's got
the same, first name,
and he seems to have sort of a similar attitude regarding legality.
Yeah, what is the law anyway?
Yeah,
to a cop. He's in cahoots with some bad dudes.
Yes.
Yeah.
A mattress factory that's like laundering drug money, and then there's an arrest. But he's sort of trying to spring the guy. They jump back and forth a lot. It's a tricky plot to keep up with.
The plot in general is he has left Romania for the Canary Islands.
Yes.
And that is where part of this, caper is taking place.
Yes.
While he's there, he has to learn an indigenous whistling language so that he can speak to the crime people.
Yes.
And he spends a good chunk of the movie trying to learn this whistling language. Although, there's not much payoff for the whistling language.
There is eventually.
Eventually, yes. But in the course of the crime taking place, there's not.
Yeah, it is kind of like, why don't they just text?
I mean, if they texted, that could be picked up.
There would be a paper trail. Yeah, sure.
The whistling language is meant to elude
the authorities.
The authorities, although he is one.
He is an authority.
He's one of the authorities.
So we're jumping back and forth in time. The cop is under police investigation for this money that he had hidden that his mother finds in the cellar and gives to the church. And so he's constantly under surveillance. And then you find out that even the other cops are under surveillance for whatever reasons. Like his boss, whenever they really have to talk about anything, she has to pretend to go outside to get cigarettes.
Right.
So they can have a conversation in the hallway away from the bugs and the cameras or whatever. Yeah. There is a woman named Gilda, because it's that kind of movie.
She's color-coded in red.
Yes.
Her car is red, her dress is red.
Yes.
She is the femme fatale.
Exactly. Yeah. And, so their relationship begins strictly business-like, but clearly something is unfolding between them. The Police Adjective, as the title suggests, has a lot to do with language and how language can be used as a method of coding, as a way of excluding people from conversations or from understanding certain things. And that's an idea that gets picked up again here.
Ultimately, where you're going with this is a fully accurate. This is less about the plot and the mechanics of the plot.
Sure.
And the crime itself and who's, committing the crime and who's trying to, run around and sabotage someone else. It's less about that than it is about Porumbuyu playing with, crime movie conventions.
Yes.
At one point, there's a scene where he and the woman meet to discuss something in a repertory house where The Searchers is showing. At another point, another film is playing on TV. It's a Romanian crime movie that we've never seen.
Yeah.
There is also action that takes place on a film set.
Yes.
And the introduction of a filmmaker who exists only to be a throwaway, like, punchline in the film. So he's playing with the language of crime movies.
Yes.
And
compared to other Romanian New Wave movies, this is like Tarantino.
Yeah. At the same time, he is calling back all of the things he's done in the past with Police Adjective and with Infinite Football. He is examining how people exist in systems of rule. So this is a film that takes place partially in Romania, mm-hmm. where all of the Romanian New Wave from... to one degree or another, is talking about the fallout, the lingering, ongoing after effects of communist rule.
Yes.
And now that they no longer have that.
There's a whole discussion here about whether or not his father ever took bribes.
Right. This is a filmmaker who also made a comedy called The Treasure about people who have to secretly dig up money that has been hidden on their own property to avoid all the wild bureaucratic rules involved in digging up money that's on your own property. So Police Adjective, The Treasure, and Infinite Football are about people bucking systems of rule and of authority.
Bureaucracy.
Trying to figure out bureaucracy and trying to figure out ways around it. Police Adjective, particularly, is a film about the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law, and how people navigate that when nothing matters anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The lines between cops and robbers are not just blurred. They're
erased. Obliterated.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the whistling does pay off, but I didn't want to say how.
Sure.
But, no, I won't say how.
Won't, but it...
This is a very cool, very weird movie, much like every other Canelio Porumbuyu film.
I would say, in my review for The Wrap, I said, if you've never watched a Romanian New Wave
movie, it's a good place to start.
It's a great place to start, yeah. Because you don't have to look at, like, minute-long shots of a Bucharest skyscraper while people are trying to find a parking space, which you will get to in other films. This will warm you up toward that, because you will have to super pay attention anyway, because it is,
yeah.
Because the elliptical timeline and everything, you know, everything matters. But yeah, I like this very much.
So when it comes to you, and it just might, because it's Magnolia.
Yeah, Magnolia's got it. It opened this weekend, at least in New York and LA.
Yeah, it's Magnolia, so it'll hit major art house theaters around the country.
For
so,
sure.
If you've never seen a Romanian film before, do it.
Why not?
And then watch Sierra Nevada.
And then when you're really feeling it, 4 weeks, 3 months, and 2 days,
well,
it's on Criterion.
That's a tough one.
It is a tough one, but it's a
that's
great movie.
That's the toughest of them.
No, I know. Look, that is a movie that
The Death of Mr. Lazarescu is really great as well.
Did Porumbuyu also do 1208 East of Bucharest, or is that something else?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, these are really great, really important movies.
Yeah, because we say they are.
Yes, indeed. Do you have a DVD pick?
Oh, do I have a DVD pick?
Mine is...
Please, yeah, have one. I just you caught me off guard, and I don't have one this week. I'm sorry.
Mine is Her Smell, because
yeah,
Elizabeth Moss is one of our great actresses right now, and a lot of people did not see this performance in this film from Alex Ross Perry that came out last year, where she plays a troubled rock star trying to put her pieces back together. It is an exciting and... multifaceted performance. I can't recommend it highly enough.
And it's tough to watch her come unraveled.
It is. But I think of all of Alex Ross Perry's films, it is the most, it offers the most redemption to its difficulty.
It has the most compassion, for
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what my thing is. I'm thinking about my chicken.
Yes.
On the stove.
You've got orzo
and I've
on
got
your mind.
Things I've got to do to it. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I have a letter, though, that I can read.
Great.
For us.
Do that.
Right now. This is from Landon. And this will be the one letter we read because it's quite long.
Okay.
As a fan and supporter of Linoleum Knife for the past 4 years, as well as an avid reader of both your writing for many years prior, I figured it was time to write in to express my gratitude. Thank you, Landon. not just for the weekly opinions and recommendations you give on the show, but for the influence you both have provided me in developing my own taste and method of watching film as early as my adolescence. When I was 12, back in 2005, I'm 27 now, I spent a lot of my free time roaming the internet attempting to consume as much film criticism as I could, watching endless reruns of Siskel and Ebert and reading Ebert's website rather religiously. However, 2005 was also the year I stumbled upon Dave's writing on movies.com.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Stop.
No, you and I have talked about this before. I didn't become a film critic until 2010-ish, 2011, when they took me off the write snarky bullet points about films and write an actual review about a film. So even though I was writing about film for 10 years, I was not a critic. I was an entertainment writer. I was a person watching movies and coming up with goofy things to say about them for the sake of a bullet point format that was imposed upon me by an editor that I love and who gave me lots of work and who wanted that very specific thing for the site, but it should never be confused with actual criticism. I was developing my skills, but I wasn't writing reviews.
Be that as it may, I think you managed to find a way to make a film like A Time for Drunken Horses sound like something that mainstream readers might want to go see.
Well, you should. It's Kurdish, and it's really good.
And that is a talent.
All right. The site quickly got bookmarked on my parents' fossil of a desktop computer, and for the next few years until sometime in 2015, yes, exactly, when I quit movies.com, because they sucked. Acted as an archive of opinions I often went back to when exploring the backlog of films from that era. Among my favorites of your reviews for the site were for Jackass Number 2, which was the first review I saw to give the film the perfect 5 out of 5 score it deserves, and Snakes on a Plane, where you fully recognized how pointless and silly the concept of reviewing the film would be, and instead decided to review The Crowd. From the sold-out 10:15 screening at the Mann Chinese Sixth Theater in Hollywood, Snakes on a Plane also received a perfect 5-star rating. Going through middle school as a teenager in a small town who didn't always connect with other people's interests, watching movies and reading film criticism was something that helped me make sense of the world and acted as a great creative outlet. Because of this, it made all the more rewarding at 15 years old, when Dave accepted my friend request on Facebook and was so kind when I messaged him, telling me how much his writing had influenced me, to which he replied, "Thank you, I like being influential."
See, you're an influencer.
Not anymore, I don't like it. For the past decade, both of your opinions, whether it be For Linoleum Knife, What the Flick, Who Shot Ya, Breakfast All Day, guest appearances on other podcasts, or local radio shows, have acted as benchmarks for my taste in film and greatly influenced how I deconstruct and critique film in general. Landon, this is too much responsibility for me. Cannot...
But that is his own taste.
Thank you very much.
Just help coax him in a direction.
I do want to thank you.
That's lovely.
For everything. And now he has a list. This list is not my top 10 favorites of all time. Instead, this is a list I'm just curious about your opinions of. All of these films I love and could arguably consider favorites, so I would be interested to hear your thoughts. With that, here they are in alphabetical order. Now, if you haven't heard us do this before, we are going to knife this list.
Yes.
Assign Landon a knife percentage. How knife is his list?
Okay.
Dave Chappelle's Block Party.
I've never seen it. I know people love it. I've never seen it.
Oh, how I loved it. Dave Chappelle has bothered me and annoyed me in recent years with his inability, his stubborn inability to understand queer people's lives, specifically trans people's lives.
Yes.
And I wish he would smarten up, because I know he is smart. He's just being stubborn, and I want him to stop that. However, in 2005, oh, did I love Dave Chappelle's Block Party.
Michelle Gondry, right?
Michelle Gondry.
Yeah.
Dear Zachary, from 2008. I never saw that movie.
Oh, I think you did.
Did I?
I think we hate that movie.
What is that movie?
That's the documentary.
Remind me.
That's the documentary where at the very end they tell the kid his dad was in the Twin Towers on 9/11.
Oh my God, that one.
Yeah.
No, I can't. That's not the one.
No.
I can't with that movie.
Sorry, Landon. No.
The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
No.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. When The Diving Bell and the Butterfly came out, it was 2007, mm-hmm. and I was 3 years into my mother's particular situation.
Right.
In 2004, she had a stroke, a massive stroke, and wound up living in a nursing home under 24-hour care for the next 8 years.
And more to the point of Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
More to the point of Diving Bell and the Butterfly. The stroke took away my mother's ability to read and write and speak. So she had all the thoughts and she had all the things she wanted to say. She couldn't say them. And she and I communicated through yes and no questions. And that was some work. When I saw Diving Bell and the Butterfly, I was so immersed in that mm-hmm. that I remember being very, very moved by it and very affected by it. I found it to be, you know, pretty overwhelming mm-hmm. in terms of its emotional impact on me. 13 years later, is it a good movie? I do not know. I know a lot of critics hated it at the time.
I was one.
And you were one of them. But I remember being very deeply affected by it
gotcha.
Because of that specific scenario that was existing in my own life.
Gotcha.
So, Fly Away Home.
I need to see
oh
that.
Oh, my God.
You've been telling me for years I need to see that.
I've mm-hmm. been telling you about Fly Away Home since it came out in 1996.
Yes.
Holy cow. If y'all can get a chance to see
I think
this movie.
It was on Criterion Channel recently.
Is it?
It still is, yeah.
Little baby Anna Paquin mm. is in it as a girl who helps geese learn to migrate. I know that sounds weird, but it's not. And it's incredibly moving and such a beautiful, beautiful film. Ghost World? Yes.
Yes.
Happiness? Todd Solondz?
Yes.
Yes. The Muppet Christmas Carol? Sure, fine.
Yeah, okay.
Pleasantville?
I'm not a fan.
It's fine. I don't hate it.
I like that movie in theory, but I remember seeing it being like, this doesn't quite...
Yeah. Mm. Punch Drunk Love? Yes.
Yes.
The Squid and the Whale? Yes.
Yes.
Landon, you are 85% knife.
That's pretty good.
You get half of me and half of him for Diving Bell and the Butterfly, but we can't deal with Dear Zachary. Here's what I would love to know, Landon. What about Dear Zachary are you into?
Yeah.
Please respond to that question. I'll you can just send it back to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. I really want to know.
Yeah. Because that movie made us angry.
That movie made us angry, yeah. So anyway. Thank you for the letter.
Thank you, Landon. That was very lovely. We appreciate it. It's weird. Like this show will have been on for 10 years come November.
In November, right. Right.
And the thought of like somebody who is 27 now,
right,
reading you at 12,
right,
it's like, yeah, 10 years is a huge chunk of people's
yes, it
lives
is.
So
yeah.
Like there are people who maybe started listening to us in like high school and they're now out in the world doing stuff.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Anyway, thank you all for listening. We super appreciate it. Do check out our friends on the internet. Go to the Critically Acclaimed Network and see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to. Listen to the Schmoes Know, Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Secretly Timid, All Things Cozy, Comics Canon, did I say that? Sewers of Paris.
I don't remember.
Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, a Big Fat Gay Podcast. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, CastBox. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you to Blue for our wonderful theme music. He resides at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And, of course, we reside at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yep. Hey, so here's what you get if you go on Patreon and start subscribing. We have a whole bunch of stuff. You want to pay for it, you can have it. You subscribe at $1 a month, you get a sticker, and you get Linoleum. You get Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
Mm-hmm. Extra episodes where we
talk about one movie.
Yes.
You get LKRX, which is a daily cultural recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do your OKRX this week?
I did the...
How many did you do?
I did a couple.
And how many is a couple?
I think I did two.
You are bad.
I know.
You're a very bad person.
I'm sorry. Sorry, dollar members. I'll get on that.
No, you're not going to get on it because this week is my week and I won't fail them like you have.
Okay, fine.
How about that?
Okay.
I hope you think about what you've done.
We offer a lot. More shows.
At $4 a month, you get LKTV, which is a podcast about television. At $7 a month, you get Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a podcast where I will tell you all about the food I am making right now.
Yes.
Plus other weird food-related subjects.
So much food.
It is a food podcast hosted by people who are absolutely unqualified to host a food podcast.
But we do it anyway.
But we do it anyway because we have a dream and we believe it ourselves.
And we're very hungry.
Also, if you subscribe at the $12 level, you get to be a part of the Linoleum Knife Club meeting every month. This month, we could just announce it now. We're going to watch Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory because popular demand.
People asked
for it. Don't get big ideas, y'all, who asked for it. We don't take requests. But when y'all requested it last month, Alonzo said, hey, what if we watch Willy Wonka? I said, sure, fine, whatever. I'm always in the mood to watch Willy Wonka again.
Sure, why not?
At $16, you get Linoleum Nights.
Yes.
Where we talk about anything we feel like talking about. Mm-hmm. Quite often political rants, where you will learn that we are far more left-wing than you ever thought we were. And we do lots of cussing.
It's true.
And
it's
then
the one non-clean show.
$20 a month, you get to be a part of a thing called LK Selector, and that's coming up this month as well.
Yes.
We're finally going to talk about shoplifters, y'all, who are at that level. And that's it. So, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yes, make it part of your life.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening. We appreciate it. We'll catch you guys next time. And until then,
goodbye.